Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning. This episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of child abuse, war, violence, ethnic cleansing, genocide, enslavement, cannibalism, incest, and other sexual themes.
The Ferocious One of Undaba. The Ferocious One of Umbelebele Division. That raged in huge homesteads. That raged till the next day. The axe that is stronger than other axes. Nodumuledzi, son of Menzi, the unbeaten one, the son of Senzangakona. Shaka, I'm afraid to call him by his name, Shaka. Shaka was the king of Imashobeni Valley, the joke of the women from Nomagabi. They made fun of him seated by Umlovo River. They said Shaka would never rule. They said he would never be king. The wildfire. Yes, son of Mjokwani, the dominant lion, tall one, the descendant of Undaba. Sour milk spilt, the calabash shattered. The bull that bellows at Imothonjeneni. All nations heard it. The buffalo that crosses fords. The snake that bites as though it's possessed. The young viper that raged with little effort. Tough rod that puts its shield across the knee. The buffalo that waded with a spear, who while attacking some people, he would attack even more. Who while attacking some people, he would attack even more. Who while attacking some people, he would attack even more. Hail, elephant! Mercury! Reed of the soil, he who is as big as his nation. Hail, your majesty. The laudatory praises of Emperor Shaka Ka Senzangakona from the Zulu Empire decolonized, the epic story of the Zulu from pre-colonial times to the 21st century by Shalo Imbata, 2021. There was nothing else they could do. The Indunas, or counselors, and the war generals all agreed. It was bad enough in Zulu society that King Jama's wife gave birth to a girl. But the fact that his wife gave birth to twin girls was truly beyond the pale. Twins amongst the Nguni-speaking AmaZulu tribe were a terrible omen. They believed one of the newborns would have to die, or the Zulu domain was certain to face hardship after hardship. This practice likely originated when families deemed twins an unmanageable expense. Regardless, King Jama would have to choose a newborn for death. His wife, already of an ill disposition, was distraught. She blamed herself for the quote-unquote shame she had just brought upon the Zulu people, and fell into a deep depression. King Jama had already defied Zulu law by refusing to take another wife besides his beloved. Now, if he chose to leave both twin daughters alive, he would only invite ruin and destruction to the AmaZulu, or the people of heaven. Looking into the face of his two offspring, King Jama simply could not bring himself to execute either. He let both live, in spite of numerous protests and threats of ill omens to his kingdom. That night, and during the following weeks, whole villages deserted the Zulu for other lands. One of the twins, Mkabayi, reminded Jama of his father, Ndaba. Mkabayi would become one of the most important women in all of African and arguably world history. she would be directly responsible for the reigns of 4 separate Zulu kings. She is the only woman listed amongst the Zulu pantheon of leaders. Some have called her a web weaver or a master manipulator. Some probably claim the omens turned out to be true, but Nkabayi committed every sin for what she believed was the betterment of her people. Her hidden story is only one of tens of thousands which made the Zulu Empire one of the mightiest nation-states in all of the Southern African Peninsula. As stated, the Zulu were Nguni speakers, many of whom descended from the great Bantu migrations which began in 2000 BCE. The Bantu, much like their northern Eurasian Indo-Aryan counterparts, were an industrious, militant, and dexterous people. They likely originated in modern-day Nigeria or Cameroon. Many remained and formed complex societies and empires, but others set off on a great migration. Some went south following the Atlantic coast. It was here that Bantu descendants founded the Kingdom of Congo, while other Bantu migratory vanguards settled as far as modern-day Angola before European arrival. Another segment of Bantu people migrated from their Nigerian homelands to modern-day Uganda and around Lake Victoria. They raised mighty empires like Great Zimbabwe and the Bagunda. The Bantu traveled as far as southeastern Africa, where the Nguni language and culture developed. As time progressed, Nguni speakers split into 3 distinct cultural varieties: northern, northwestern, and southern, remembered today as the Zulu, Swazi, and Xhosa. They lived alongside hunter-gatherers like the San and Khoisan peoples. This resulted in a cultural and linguistic melding with many of these peoples. Specifically, the Nguni language developed clicks in their language, which is distinct from all other Bantu language groups. Throughout their previous migrations, the Bantu either assimilated with or removed the hunter-gatherers with whom they came into contact. The Nguni inhabited the territory east of the Drakensberg Mountains all the way to the coast of the Indian Ocean. From the south, the Great Fish River marked their boundary with hunter-gatherers, while their northern boundary was around Kosi Bay, which is similar to the modern-day demarcation between South Africa and Mozambique. The Swazi people were the third branch of the Nguni culture. They founded their own kingdom and jealously guarded their mountain fastness. Their borders largely correlate with the modern-day country of Eswatini, formerly the Kingdom of Swaziland. The development and spread of the Swazi language, as well as their migration, were affected greatly by European arrival and colonization. The southernmost Xhosa people were in constant conflict with hunter-gatherers and then European colonizers. They fought numerous small wars with both of these groups. Finally, the AmaZulu, a small tribe, was located east of the Drakensberg Mountains, north of the Mzimkulu River, and southeast of the Swazi Highlands. The AmaZulu were pastoralists, meaning their lives largely revolved around animal husbandry. Their social structure was patriarchal in the extreme. Everything revolved around the patriarch, while his cattle were used as currency. Some women were deemed to be, quote-unquote, worth thousands of heads of cattle, and many Zulu women simply refused to be taken as a bride unless some amount of cattle or goats were handed over. In spite of the patriarchal nature of Nguni society, the matriarch served one of the most important roles in any family. They were largely responsible for educating the young men. Shalo Mbatha says grandmothers taught their brood, quote, about the female anatomy and the importance of sexually satisfying a woman, unquote. Boys were encouraged to take as many lovers as possible, a Zulu society saw this as a sign of strength and virility. The flip side of this coin was that if a Zulu wife was found cheating, it was considered the fault of the husband because he had not pleased his wife enough. A girl could choose to become a member of the royal harem. This made her Mdlunkulu, or a flower of the nation. And the king could marry and have children with these girls without having to officially make them his quote-unquote wives. Before marriage, women and girls were allowed up to 4 lovers at any one time. However, it was a great sin to go all the way with one of your sweethearts. If such an impropriety was discovered, the girl or woman, her family, and even the village she was from would be shamed. Instead, Zulu teens and adults practiced a form of non-penetrative sex before marriage. This practice was considered especially important for warriors to partake in. They were required by law to perform with the first unmarried, obliging woman that they met. It was felt that if the warriors did not release their quote-unquote anxieties from the battlefields, they would become a danger to society at large. This act was called Ukusulu Izembe, or to wipe the axe clean. Clearly, sexual prowess and dominance were incredibly important aspects of Zulu life. In fact, when King Shaka was growing up, he was teased mercilessly for not quote-unquote developing fast enough when compared to the other boys in his village. Nguni society revolved around sex and cattle. Anyone lacking in either of these things would be on the outside looking in. Each head of the family usually owned his own kraal, which is a series of stone structures usually surrounding a cattle enclosure. The enclosures were usually circular and penned in with large stones. Each husband had to provide each new wife he acquired with a room all her own, as well as her own animals like chickens and goats. In return, wives reared children, took care of husbands in their old age, and managed the households. The head of the house would usually locate his adobe at the center of the kraal, closest to his beloved cattle. This was likely done to better shield his flock from wild animals or to warn him in case of raids. Divorce was unheard of, but a Zulu wife could move back home and remarry so long as her family repaid the dowry of cattle or goats the husband originally paid for her. In time, marriage was used by Shaka and future Zulu monarchs as a privilege to be granted or taken away. Only he could decree when it was time for his people to get married and have children. Prior to Shaka, the AmaZulu tribe was relatively mediocre when compared to their direct neighbors. They had neither a massive herd of cattle with which to barter, nor a large army with which to defend themselves. It was due to this that early Zulu chiefs were constantly harassed and even imprisoned by their larger neighbors. This turned the Zulu into little more than a tributary for these larger tribes. The first member of the Zulu tribe to be penned to history was King Luzaman, or Luzamane, who reigned around 1550 to 1600. He had a son called Malandela, who had 2 children, Kwabe and Zulu. The story goes that Kwabe was the firstborn, but he was greedy and demanded not just his father's lands, but also his mother's. His mother refused, and in a rage, he and his followers left the Zulu homelands and founded the Kwabe kingdom to the east. His brother, King Zulu, had many children, and following his death, 2 of them would reign successively. Following these 2 brief reigns, Ndaba Ka Mageba became the new head of the Zulu. He is largely regarded as the first great Zulu king, who helped lay the foundation for his great-great-grandson's empire. Ndaba's son, Jama, was a contrarian to the extreme. He flouted court customs by refusing to marry another woman, he attempted to be present at the birth of his twins, and he refused to execute either of them. These twins, Nkabaye and Mama, grew up apart, isolated from each other. Mama was happy-go-lucky, and Nkabaye was dour, and Kurt. Following his wife's death, King Jama remarried, but his mood swings, which could only be soothed by his late wife, now grew into daily rages, which rapidly aged the Zulu monarch. Mkabaye decided she would look after her aged father and, by extension, the Zulu domain. Despite his infirmity, Jama now took many wives and added many women captured as quote-unquote spoils of war to his harem. He had several children with these women, but he did not produce a son with an official wife until 1757. He called him Senzangakona, or We Did Well. As Jama's health grew worse, Mkabaye became Zulu monarch in all but name. Senzangakona was showing time and again that he had little interest in ruling. He was usually found gallivanting across southern Africa, courting numerous women. Eventually, Jama would die of natural causes, supposedly leaving the Zulu kingdom in the hands of his daughter, Mkabaye. She reigned during an unprecedented time of peace and was in the process of formally handing over power to Senzangakona, but not before killing one of his brothers, who was threatening to break apart the kingdom. It was during the mid-1780s when Senzangakona would first meet Princess Nandi of the Ilangeni tribe. The story goes that the princess was out to woo Senzangakona, and while the young king, in name only, was out hunting, she made her move. This was nothing new to Senzangakona, and he thought nothing of the dalliance until Nandi found out she was pregnant. Senzangakona and his courtiers tried to dispel these quote-unquote rumors, saying that she wasn't actually pregnant. She was only suffering from the Ishaka beetle parasite, which caused stomach swelling. Needless to say, Nandi was in a terrible position. Not only did Senzangakona barely remember who she was, but she had also committed the Zulu sins of adultery and incest, as she and Senzangakona were technically first cousins. Shunned by her own tribe, cursed by the Zulu nobility, and shamed by her family, Nandi and her newborn, Shaka, born in 1787, were destined for hard, yet historic, lives. Forced to take Nandi as his third wife, Senzangakona made it his mission to be vindictive and spiteful to his new wife and his unwanted son. They quarreled continuously, and after Shaka supposedly killed one of the royal animals, they were officially expelled from the Zulu domain and forced to move back to Nandi's homeland. Shaka was now treated like a foreigner and belittled by all the other boys his age. He grew, in the words of Glenn Lyndon Dodds, quote, withdrawn, indignant, and vengeful, unquote. Around 1802, Shaka and his mother were forced to leave once more. Either Shaka had lashed out violently at his bullies, or the two were forced to flee because of drought and poverty. This time, they landed in the Mthethwa kingdom. It was here that Shaka first learned the ways of war which would eventually define his life. During this time, the Zulu kingdom was a mediocre tribe in which Mkabaye still ran things, while Senzangakona acquired a true harem horde of 40 official wives and numerous other concubines and mistresses. He had countless children and left the decision of which child should inherit in the hands of Mkabaye. During her stewardship of the realm, she kept the Zulu state afloat when it was confronted by its larger enemies. In one instance, King Senzangakona was captured by a neighboring chief, and the Zulu nation was forced to pay an extraordinary 60-cow ransom. Shalo Mbatha says that this ransom, quote, nearly bankrupted the Zulu nation, unquote. In time, the royal cattle herds of the Zulu would contain tens of thousands of heads, and each one would be shown more care than the poorest Zulu subject. Back in the Mthethwa kingdom, Prince Gadangwana was disinherited by his father. So he spent his time learning from white explorers in the area how to properly use a firearm and how to ride on horseback. Prior to this, most southern Africans believed white people were abalungu, or sea monsters, since they usually came up from the sea via shipwrecks. They also believed that these white people exclusively ate ivory, since they demanded so much of it. Returning to his homeland, Prince Gadangwana usurped his brother's claim to the throne, and having assumed leadership, he took the name Dingisweo, or the Distressed One. If Shaka could be compared to Alexander of Macedon, then Dingisweo was undoubtedly Philip II in this equation. In many ways, Dingisweo walked so that Shaka could run. It was Dingisweo who first attempted to unite the disparate tribes of the area under a single ruler. He did this largely through personal charisma and diplomacy, and only used military intervention as a last resort. Regardless, in military affairs, he introduced several new versions of war shields, which ranged from small hunting shields to the umbumbuludzo, or the sturdiest shield, which was so broad that it was often used as a parasol for Dingisweo. It was during his benevolent, yet sneakily insidious reign, that Shaka and Nandi were welcomed into the Mthethwa kingdom as refugees. Around 1809, Shaka was formally inducted into the Izikwe Special Forces Regiment of Dingisweo's army. Very rapidly, Shaka began imposing his own ideological beliefs onto the ranks of the army. Up until this point, warfare in southern Africa was a highly choreographed affair, consisting of prearranged engagements, limited casualties, and shows of personal strength and bravery. Following a defeat, an army would be able to retreat, give tribute, and escape further casualties. Shaka felt all these rules resulted in quote-unquote sham battles, and he resolved to change these centuries-old traditions and replace them with total war. His praises were sung early when he supposedly faced down a leopard with naught but a spear, and as a result, he was given the name Nodumuledzi, or legendary, even when seated. Next, Shaka introduced an entirely new spear into the army's ranks. He called this short stabbing spear the Ikloa. This name has no direct English translation and is meant to be onomatopoeic, Ikloa being the sound the spear makes when thrust into an opponent's armpit. Shaka first showcased this weapon and his style of war against the Buthelezi tribe, which Dingisweo ordered to submit to the Mthethwa. Coming upon the Buthelezi in the traditional battle line, the women hurled insults at Shaka's men, calling them quote-unquote dogs. Shaka became incensed by these provocations, and he rushed the Buthelezi. In moments, he was face-to-face with the Buthelezi warrior. Shaka bashed his shield into his opponents with such force that it exposed the Buthelezi warrior's armpit. Shaka then struck the warrior with his spear, penetrating deep into the warrior's chest with such power that it burst through his back, killing him instantly. Shaka then rushed the rest of the enemy army, who were so shocked at his brazen charge that they began a stampede for safety. However, it was too late for many of the Buthelezi. The Buthelezi chief and his mother were personally executed by Shaka. Having proved himself a loyal retainer of Dingisweo, Shaka devised a tactic which would come to define Zulu martial dominance for decades, known as the head and horns. This pincer movement was defined by experienced, well-trained men leading the vanguard and reserves, or head and chest, of the formation, while the young and agile composed the enveloping horns. Using his new spear and this new tactic, Shaka quickly became the go-to general for Dingisweo, while his soldiers developed intense admiration for and fear of Shaka. back in the Zulu domain, the exploits of Shaka in the ascendant Mthethwa Empire likely caused fear and consternation amongst the royalty and the court. Tenzangakona wasted no time in submitting to Dingisweyo, but he still refused to appoint Shaka as the official heir of the Zulu tribe. Instead, he appointed one of his many sons. This would not do for Shaka, nor Dingisweyo. Very rapidly, the chosen heir of the Zulu was murdered, and Shaka marched triumphantly into the Zulu lands to usurp leadership. His first act was to construct a new royal kraal for himself, his family, and his court. He ominously called his new capital Kwa Bulawayo, or at the place of the killing. Finally, Shaka the Parasite, who had miraculously morphed into a human child, Shaka the Lacking, Shaka the Small, was now Shaka the King. His vengeance was swift against those who mocked him or degraded his mother. Those lucky enough to go quickly were stabbed through the heart, a warrior's death. The quote-unquote most guilty were impaled through their anuses and left to suffer for days as the spike slowly penetrated deeper into their bodies. Others were set ablaze and then chased upwind. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, were executed after Shaka took power. Their bodies were left to the elements, devoured by wild dogs, ensuring their spirits would never find peace in the Zulu afterlife. Following this culling, Shaka turned to the meager armed forces of the Zulu. From a force of several hundred, the army would eventually swell to tens of thousands, largely thanks to Shaka's administrative decisions. First, he installed the Amabutho system of military service. The Amabutho system was defined by age-based groupings as opposed to the previous system of tribal-based military groupings. This meant that military units were formed based on their members' ages. This instilled a sense of togetherness amongst the Zulu army, and it helped Shaka to regulate the Zulu population. Your military unit was now what determined your ability to marry. On average, men were not allowed to marry until they were in their late 40s. Shaka reasoned that a man's age had little to do with the health of their offspring, and that young wives would simply look after their feeble husbands. Next, he demanded the army do away with their sandals as he considered them cumbersome and pointless. He walked around barefoot and demanded his soldiers did as well. After a time, Shaka determined his orders to do away with footwear were not being obeyed completely. He demanded his youth brigade, the Ufasimba, collect bushels of the devil's thorn plant and place them on the ground where the regiment usually performed dances. He began his quote-unquote test, and without losing a beat, danced hard upon the thick thorns. He demanded his army follow suit, and those who could not recreate his steps identically were executed with their own spears. Needless to say, no one dared defy Shaka's orders from then on out. Shaka also saw the importance of supplies. He formed regiments of boys and girls who operated as the army's water carriers, animal herders, and equipment managers. Recognizing the strength of European firearms, Shaka took the initial steps to equip his male and female regiments with these weapons. By the time of the Anglo-Zulu War in the late 1870s, most Zulu warriors were armed with guns of some variety. Administratively, Shaka installed a system of promotion based on merit, as opposed to family name. He also appointed older female relatives to court positions, and even to commander positions at the military bases. Shalo Mbatha says his rationale for this was, quote, "A postmenopausal woman thinks objectively like a man, because she is no longer at the mercy of hormones that wreak havoc with her mood swings," unquote. Finally, Shaka demanded an iron discipline in battle. Warriors who had wounds to the back had left their Ikliwa behind on the battlefield or were accused of cowardice were immediately executed. In spite of his draconian punishments, he enjoyed intense loyalty and admiration from the army as a whole. Within a few months, Shaka's force of will and his repurposing of Zulu life had bore bloody fruit. Several tribes in the vicinity were conquered, and they meekly submitted to Shaka, who now took to calling himself the Isidio, or Emperor. His army was now 10 times as large as it had originally been, and it would soon be 100 times larger still. Shaka remained a loyal vassal of Dengisweyo, but this did not stop his expansion at the cost of his neighbors. He started by completely destroying the Buthelezi, whom he had previously trounced while he was a commander for the Mutetwa. The Buthelezi were formed on a hill, but Shaka understood his enemy well. He commanded his warriors to carry their shields at their sides until the final moment. When they finally presented them, it gave the illusion that the Zulu forces had doubled, sending shouts of fear amongst the Buthelezi. Shaka then called the charge, and his head and chest, or vanguard and center, slammed into the Buthelezi. His regiments, denoted by their uniforms of various colors, stabbed ferociously with their spears or clubbed recklessly with their nab kuris. After killing an enemy, the Zulu warriors shouted "Ngadla," or "I have struck." As the center fought desperately for supremacy, the horns of the formation which had been creeping around the Buthelezi flank attacked, vaporizing any Buthelezi resistance. The warriors threw down their shields and ran to hide amongst their women and children. At another point in time, their surrender would have been acknowledged and their lives would have been spared. Not this time. The Zulu army killed any and all who dared to surrender themselves. They moved on to the Buthelezi capital, killing and pillaging all the way. Those still alive were moved to the depopulated areas of the Zulu domain or, quote-unquote, given out as brides to the bravest warriors. One warrior asked Shaka for 20 brides at once. This was granted, but the warrior failed to realize the daily fine he was incurring by not consummating the marriages, and his household nearly went bankrupt. At this point, the first signs of the Mfakane, or the crushing, were visible. The Mfakane was a violent and disastrous geopolitical event which witnessed the mass migration of millions of people. All across southeastern Africa, tribes were moving, fighting and destroying anything in their way in the hopes of escaping. But what exactly were they escaping? For hundreds of years, the answer was undoubtedly Shaka, Shaka, Shaka. It was Shaka, they said, who destabilized the entire region through violence, barbarism, and destruction, which caused the deaths of millions of people. This quote-unquote great man justification for the Mfakane has since fallen into disrepute amongst a newer generation of South African researchers, who now purport that climate change and environmental factors had much more to do with the Mfakane's human toll. Garstang, Coleman, and Thorell argue that volcanic activity, combined with natural ebbs in the climate, created a perfect cocktail of adverse weather conditions, including intense drought, which likely spread disease, and caused immense strain on the tribal societies of Africa, which had already been in a state of flux. Regardless, the historical record also points to another culprit which may have contributed to the start of the Mfakane much more than Shaka did. To the north of the Zulu and Mtetwa polities was the violent Ndwandwe tribe, whose matriarch was a witch and a head collector. They destroyed the Ama Ngwane, The survivors of this tribe went on a murderous rampage in search of new lands, destroying the Behele clan. The Behele's allied clan, the Amahlubi, went on a similar tear, rampaging through modern-day Lesotho until they ran into the stubborn warriors of Batlokwa. Their queen turned her armies against 30 separate surrounding nations, leaving a path of destruction up to the Botswana border. It was around here that she defeated Moshosho, who went on to become the first king of Lesotho. Another person affected by the Mfakane was Shoshangane, a minor chief who was allied with the Ndwandwe and went on to found the Empire of Gaza in modern-day Mozambique. In the global conversation surrounding the Mfakane, the role of European colonization has been pretty conveniently glossed over by many historians. They assert that the handful of Europeans living there could not seriously influence regional politics. They say nothing of the lucrative, and by this point, illegal slave trade amongst the white colonists, nor the numerous commando raids by the Dutch, who had been slowly creeping north ever since the British officially annexed the Cape Colony in 1806. Undoubtedly, climate change, European encroachment, Zulu conquests, Dutch raids, and Ndwandwe depravity all contributed to the time which is remembered by many native South Africans as the time we were obliged to eat grass. The core debate over what caused the Mfakane can be compared to the question surrounding Shaka's overall legacy. Was he a self-serving sadist? Or was he a uniter who brought disparate peoples together in order to oppose European imperialism? Both arguments have evidence to support them, but it's undeniable that European colonizers made it a point to make Shaka seem as violent as possible in the hopes of drumming up financial support from London. The reality was that Shaka was accommodating to the extreme to the whites who occasionally arrived in his domain, and he was intensely interested in the world outside of the Zulu Empire. He wanted to know, for example, why the British wore clothes, and assumed it was because they were ashamed of their pasty white skin. He was perplexed to find out that leather was used to make shoes, and considered this a serious indictment on British society and martial strength. Leather, he said, should only be used to fashion necessary things, like shields for war. He considered the weaponry of the Zulu to be far superior to that of the British, claiming that while the British were slowly reloading, his warriors would be busy closing the distance and swarming. Shaka was utterly shocked to discover that George, or King George, commanded more men in his army than Shaka had subjects or cattle in his entire domain. Finally, he felt the act of imprisonment practiced by the British was inhumane to the extreme. If a Zulu was guilty, he was killed instantly, thus preserving his honor. The Ndwandwe kingdom lies northeast of the Black Imfolozi River. In 1817, the king of this region, Zwide, and his head-collecting mother were conspiring to end Dingiswayo's life. Supposedly, she gave one of her daughters the onerous task of marrying Dingiswayo and bringing his semen back to the Ndwandwe. This was used to concoct a spell, which supposedly made Dingiswayo powerless and suggestible. Under this quote-unquote spell, he and his small guard of female warriors entered the Ndwandwe kingdom. They were ambushed and killed. Dingiswayo met an ignoble end. His head became a trophy for the Ndwandwe matriarch, Ntombanzi. When Shaka heard the story of his mentor's death, Shalo Mbatha says, quote, he vowed to avenge and recover Dingiswayo's head, and quietly lamented, Lafta eleli kakulu. This is the end of an era, unquote. It was indeed the end of an era, and the end of the short-lived Mtetwa Empire, but it was the true beginning of the Zulu Empire. King Zwide wasted no time in allying himself with two neighboring kingdoms who all mobilized their forces to crush Shaka. However, many outcasts and former Dingisweo supporters remembered Shaka's contribution and loyalty to the original empire builder, and they supported Shaka. The battle lines were being drawn for one of the most important military engagements in South African history, one which would have ramifications that were felt for generations. The Zulu were still seriously outnumbered by this multinational force. Shaka understood this disadvantage, so he used his terrain to anchor a truly masterful defensive battle. He and his main commander, Ndlela, chose the imposing Gokli Hill as their bulwark. The plan was relatively straightforward. Harass the enemy the entire way to the battlefield, harass them as they crossed the Mfolozi River, and harass them some more as they tried to ascend the hill. Finally, after the Ndwandwe were entirely exhausted, Shaka would send in the main body of the Zulu army, which would charge down the slopes and to victory. To assist him in his efforts, he employed Mkabaye to empty the entire area surrounding the hill of food and supplies, ensuring that the enemy would be hungry and exposed. The Ndwandwe were not to be taken lightly. They were master spear makers, and they were known for their prowess in war. The Ndwandwe employed a tactic that is referred to by Shalo Mbata as, quote, simulated flight, unquote. Basically, like the Mongols, they would feign a retreat, only to wheel around on their surprised enemy. Shaka was aware of this tactic, and he cautioned his men on how best to counter it. The day of battle approached, and the Ndwandwe and their allies marched to invade Zululand. As planned, they were harassed the entire way by spear throwers, and they were ambushed as they tried to cross the river. The next day, the exhausted Ndwandwe attempted to climb the formidable hill defenses before them. The terrain was unwieldy, and their formations became muddled and disorganized. Bunched together like sardines, the Ndwandwe had no hope when confronted with a downhill charge by the Zulu. The Zulu were carving up the coalition forces arrayed against them, but they were also suffering casualties in the hundreds, if not thousands. Shalo Mbatha says, quote, "Fountains of blood spurted from both the Ndwandwe and Zulu soldiers, and they tried to stop the bleeding by stuffing grass, leaves, or hair into their wounds to continue fighting," unquote. The Ndwandwe position seemed hopeless. Zwide had already escaped alongside one of his sons, but five princes of Ndwandwe lay slain, as well as thousands of their warriors. Realizing victory was close at hand, Shaka dispatched his reserves to march ahead of the Ndwandwe army and capture their capital. They burned it to the ground, but back at Gokli Hill, the Ndwandwe forces had rallied and collapsed the Zulu center. This put Shaka in immediate danger. He was forced to retreat and made a last stand around his capital with his Ufasimba regiment. In the confused fight, Shaka miraculously escaped unharmed, returned to the main battle on the hill, and inspired his men to end all Ndwandwe resistance. This fight ended in a Zulu victory as the Ndwandwe were forced back to their homelands, with only a handful of usurped Zulu cattle to show for thousands of their own dead. They tried to invade once more in 1819, but this time Shaka had prepared the perfect strategy for their destruction. He employed scorched earth tactics along the Ndwandwe's route of march, and it proved highly effective at sapping manpower and strength from their forces. Shaka followed their bedraggled army and struck at night, ordering small units to sow chaos behind the lines. The Ndwandwe were tracked to the Mlatuzi River. Over the course of a two-day battle, the entire Ndwandwe army was destroyed. After defeating the Ndwandwe, Shaka destroyed the Kwabe Kingdom, officially incorporating it into the Zulu Empire. a territory which was now over 11,000 square miles large. He was able to call up an army of as many as 40,000 men to be ready for a campaign on a week's notice. He still had unfinished business in the form of Ntombazi, the Ndwandwe matriarch and Dingiswayo's murderer. He sentenced her to life imprisonment, which was to be served in a small hut. Once dragged inside, she quickly came to realize that her cellmate was a hungry hyena. Over the course of several days, the animal slowly ate her. At the end of the torment, the matriarch of the Ndwandwe was completely insane. She begged her jailers to set her and the hyena ablaze. They complied with her last request, and as the flames engulfed her, she supposedly shouted up to the sky, quote, "Dingiswayo," unquote. Shaka set about repopulating the Ndwandwe domains. He granted over 1,000 ceremonial head rings, or isikoko, to the bravest fighters, finally allowing them to get married and start families. Additionally, he moved the capital to a more central location in the Zulu domain. Kwabulawayo was now closer to the former lands of the Kwabe. He attacked the south first, running off Masingwane and his marauder tribe of cannibals. Then he moved against the mountain people of the Mefethwa kingdom. The second group were master spear throwers. Against their barrages, Shaka devised the millipede formation, which was incredibly similar to the Roman military's testudo or tortoise formation. Soldiers would form their shields above, in front, and to the side of themselves in a single, tight formation in order to better repel missile bombardment. It was a perfect counter to the spear throwers, who chose to throw themselves from their mountain strongholds rather than submit to Zulu overlordship. Shaka moved his armies north once more and promoted a man named Mzilikazi to the position of general. His mission was to extend the Zulu domain, but he very quickly gained his own following and took off towards the northwest to found the Matebele kingdom, sometimes called the Inland Zulu. They were as competent in war as the Zulu, and the story of Mzilikazi mirrors that of Shaka in many respects. After failing to report in, Shaka sent a division, or impi, of men to subdue Mzilikazi, but he escaped. This act of treachery forced Shaka's hand, and he decreed that everyone in his domain was Zulu first and their own tribe second. This laid the groundwork for Zulu nationalism. Regardless, Mzilikazi continued his flight and was a thorn in the side of Zulu monarchs for many years to come. In spite of this antagonistic relationship, Mzilikazi clearly respected Shaka to a great degree, even naming his capital Bulawayo after Shaka's capital city of the same name. The modern-day city of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe is still home to many people who can trace their ancestry back to the Zulu. South of Zululand, the internal squabbles and geopolitical chess moves barely registered with the white men in Cape Town. They were the descendants of the original Dutch and French Huguenot populations. They called themselves Afrikaans, literally Africans, while newer whites from Germany and Great Britain were called Uitlanders, or Outlanders. Anytime they referred to the native peoples, they used slurs. They trafficked the natives and enslaved them. They also frequently raped the native population of women. The children who were born of this horrific act comprised the Griqua population of mixed-race Dutch and Native African peoples. The term colored was used during this time to legally describe any person who had both African and European ancestry. The British colonists who first wrote of Shaka looked down on him, but interestingly enough, they were exactly like him. They all took numerous Zulu wives and lived in their own kraals. Several white, quote-unquote, subjects of Shaka were even called upon to serve in the Zulu armed forces. They participated in 1826 and fought against the revived Ndwandwe kingdom under its one surviving heir. This time, the Head and Horns formation, in conjunction with a musket-armed contingent of white men, helped the Zulu win the day with ease as they swamped the Ndwandwe. Shaka ordered the entire tribe extinguished. Old men, women, and children were butchered in the thousands. Having crushed his most formidable enemies, Shaka believed the Zulu Empire had achieved something like stability and peace. To be clear, Shaka was always attacking or raiding some tribe on the distant boundaries of his empire. But in the capital and the other major kraals, prosperity increased significantly. During this period, Shaka became more acquainted with the white colonists of the recently founded settlement of Natal. A natural harbor, Natal was a perfect place for British colonists to set up shop. The main obstacle to European colonization of Central and Southern Africa was African horse disease. Spread by flies, also called midges, in the area, horse disease could kill a perfectly healthy stallion in a matter of hours. Vaccinations now prevent many fatal instances of the disease, but for unvaccinated stallions and mares, AHD was a virtual death sentence. Those that did survive were highly prized and were usually overworked into an early grave. Unable to properly scout or reconnoiter an area, the British were routinely outmaneuvered in their battles to come against the Zulu and other native African peoples. Shaka was at his zenith, and seemingly nothing could bother him. He became fascinated with hair dye, which he seems to have believed reversed the effects of aging. He demanded Henry Francis Finn, a British colonist and doctor, send him the miraculous immortality elixir. He also asked that Finn attempt to heal his dying grandmother. Finn wrote of Shaka's love for his grandmother, quote, "When he happened to visit her, he frequently washed her eyes and ears, and otherwise treated her as a father might his child. We could hardly believe that a man of apparent unfeeling disposition could be possessed of such affection and consideration for others," unquote. Shaka's grandmother passed, and to honor her memory, Shaka renamed the Zulu Empire after her. Another strange aspect of Shaka's life is that he fathered no known heirs, although some postulate that Cetshwayo was actually the illegitimate son of Shaka. Regardless, there are several theories as to why he had no official wives. Some have speculated that this was because Shaka was gay. They point to his quote-unquote use of his own soldiers for pleasure as evidence of this. There is extensive evidence of same-sex relations all across southern Africa. Whether it be the Khoisan female warriors who took their own wives, or the reports of same-sex relationships being crucial to Zulu warriors prior to battle. This history is often ignored by modern African leaders like the current Zulu monarch, who has called same-sex relationships quote-unquote rotten, and has incorrectly asserted that homosexuality and LGBTQIA+ individuals did not exist in Africa prior to European arrival. In reality, Europeans were the first to officially pass sodomy laws against what they considered the quote-unquote blasphemous sexual activity of the natives. To be clear, there is about as much evidence to support Shaka having many female lovers, but none whom he chose to acknowledge as his official wife. We know that Shaka wanted no male heirs, as he was certain they would try to kill him. Eventually, Shalo Mbatha says Shaka impregnated one of his many lovers, who gave birth to a boy. In a strange twist of fate, Shaka was now the father of an unwanted child, and he treated the boy and the boy's mother much like Senzangakona treated Shaka and Nandi. Nandi did all she could to keep her grandchild close, but in time the child and mother were exiled to the distant north of the empire. Nandi was inconsolable at the loss of her grandchild. her health declined rapidly, and on October 10, 1827, Nandi, Queen Mother of the Zulu, was dead. Shaka was utterly despondent, and the entire Zulu domain lamented Nandi's death alongside him. 50,000 souls shouted and wailed around Bulawayo, each one trying to outperform the other's grief. The Prime Minister decreed a year of mourning, banning all forms of harvesting, planting, lovemaking, cow milking, and the rearing of calves. These decrees should have been immediately reversed by Shaka, but he was in a state of depression so deep that nothing mattered to him anymore. His entire world, his mother, was gone. Already, Shaka had shown a propensity for arbitrary violence. To impress his white guests and assert his power, he would often order the execution of random people. Sometime after the final crushing of the Ndwandwe, he had massacred many of his own courtiers whom he believed were sleeping with his harem. The loss of life and wanton destruction following Nandi's death, however, was something entirely new. The morning after Nandi's death was violence and death incarnate. Shaka was dressed in full battle regalia, and the streets were filled with hungry, sleep-deprived people crying desperately in grief. Shaka took up a war chant and immediately began ordering executions of the least enthusiastic. The crowd took matters into their own hands, and in a mad frenzy, they went street to street and killed any who did not show enough grief. Maybe 7,000 men, women, and children died by each other's hands in a mad cacophony of violence. Shaka moved to a new capital, Dukuza, where he continued in a deep state of depression for many months. As he wallowed, Zulu people starved, and the countryside fell into disrepair. Shalo Mbatha relates what happened next, quote, "It took one impassioned man, Gala Ka Nodade Biela, to bring an end to the madness. So Gala woke up one morning, put on his best attire, and told his family that he would not be half the man he thought he was if he did not confront Shaka. Gala reminded Shaka that his mother's death was not the end of the world, that death was inevitable. That is why there is no need to punish the living. He also told him that if he did not rescind the terrible orders, he would have no subjects, because Inkosi Yinkosi Ngabantu, a king is only a king because of his subjects." Unquote. Far from killing Gala on the spot, the man's words seemed to awaken Shaka from his stupor. He gave Gala's regiment the right to marry and immediately rescinded the orders which caused so much unease and death to his subjects. In 1828, Shaka tried to formally cement diplomatic ties between the United Kingdom and the Zulu Empire. He sent a delegation of his Indunas to Cape Town with explicit instructions, but they were not allowed to carry out their mission. Instead, they were detained and questioned in Cape Town by colonial authorities. The colonial authorities were obviously worried about the Zulu Empire, and when the Zulu began attacking the Xhosa tribes to the south, the colonial authorities were sure this was the first step in a plan to invade Cape Town directly. They mobilized a small army to defend the border, and they believed they inflicted two defeats on the Zulu, but in fact, the Cape Town militia defeated two smaller tribes who had been attempting to flee the Zulu conquest. This state of never-ending conflict was clearly wearing on the Zulu people. Conspiracies and assassination attempts had already been in the works since 1828, but they were usually half-baked. Now, Dingane and Malangana, Shaka's half-brothers, were in serious talks about how to end Shaka's life. They turned to Nkabayi for support, telling her that Shaka had actually killed Nandi and that she could be next. Dingane further explained that the best and brightest were being sent away to die in useless raids against any and all Zulu enemies. When all else failed, Dingane weaponized Nkabayi's pride, asking if she could seriously continue to keep her head buried in the sand while the empire crumbled. Nkabayi took a night to think it over, but come the morning, she was resolved. Shaka, the monster, Shaka, the murderer of his own mother, would have to die. Nkabayi went around gathering conspirators, all while avoiding Shaka's spies and secret service. In spite of not understanding the true nature of the conspiracy, Shaka clearly understood something was amiss within his so-called family. He appointed his two conspiratorial brothers to lead a campaign to the far north in September of 1828. Here he planned their execution at the hands of men loyal to him. However, halfway to the battle theater, Dingane and Malangana both feigned illness and returned home to quote-unquote recover. This northern campaign against the Swazi was beset with problems and was inadequately supplied, which was a first for the Zulu. Their foragers and their supply units were not at the front because they had stayed behind in order to learn how to use European firearms and improve their design. Mbofa, a fellow conspirator, was to give the sign to begin the ambush on Shaka. Shaka was in the middle of his morning routine and was inspecting the supply carriers which he had just formed into a fighting regiment. Mbofa came on the scene shouting at the troops to disperse themselves. This was the signal Dingane and Malangana were waiting for, and they burst from their hidden place, spears in hand. Dingane supposedly shouted, quote, "You shall never see the sun set again," unquote, as he and Malangana stabbed repeatedly at Shaka's body. Freeing himself, Shaka shouted back, quote, "Really? Are you really killing me, my brothers? But what have I done to you, my father's children? What have I done, Dingane? What have I done, Malangana? Really, you are killing me for the throne, but you will never reign. Birds of the sky, or white people, are coming. I swear by Jama, you will not rule. It will be ruled by birds," unquote. Shaka collapsed from blood loss and lost consciousness. But the stabbing continued until Dingane and Malangana were sure the Isilo was no more. Emperor Shaka Ilembe Usigidi Unodumulezi Kamenzi Udulungwana Wombelebele Kazenzangakona died between the age of 38 and 41. Upon his death, it is said a tornado sprang up and devastated numerous areas of Zululand. The killers debated as to what should happen to Shaka's body. Malangana wanted to bury him. Mbofa wanted to leave him where he was to be eaten by dogs. But Dingane was worried that if this happened, Shaka would become an evil spirit and haunt him until the end of time. They left Shaka's body where it was, while rain fell like buckets on the gruesome scene. Shalo Mbatha says that not a single dog or hyena dared take a bite out of the former emperor's body because one of Shaka's lovers scared off the hyenas and scavengers, all while maintaining a mournful vigil through the night. When Nkabayi realized this was the case, she ordered Shaka buried with all the pomp of previous Zulu monarchs. Others claim his body was dumped unceremoniously into a granary pit, which was then filled in with stones and mud. Nkabayi then ordered anyone who might resist the new regime to be quote-unquote neutralized. One person they could not simply neutralize was Ndlaka, commander-in-chief of the Zulu army. For nearly a decade, he was loyal to Shaka and never lost a battle. Now he openly called Dingane a traitor and challenged any who disagreed with him to single combat. Nkabayi acted quickly in order to stifle rebellion in the army. She lavishly handed out isiCoco to many of the officers and rewarded others, like Ndlaka, with a huge number of royal cattle. Next, she turned on her former conspirators, fomenting hatred and controversy between the brothers. First to go was Mbofa. He was killed by Malangana, who was then killed by Dingane on the orders of Uncabayi. For a moment following Malangana's death, it seemed the two armed factions would come to blows, and a Zulu civil war would begin. Uncabayi stepped up once more and settled the issue by chanting the traditional Zulu song, proclaiming a new king. She sang, quote, "Ndaba is king. The son of Ndaba is calling us. He called us and we agreed. He is the king of humanity," unquote. The two Zulu factions ceased their near-deadly encounter and joined one another in embracing their new king, Dingane Kazenzangakona. Having captured the Zulu crown through violence, duplicity, and murder, Dingane set out to hold the Zulu crown through violence, duplicity, and murder. In the next episode of the Turning Tides podcast, Dingane will be confronted not just by rival tribes like the Matabele, but by an entirely new threat. Surging their way north, the Afrikaner population would run smack dab into the Zulu kingdom. The confrontation between these two peoples would come to define the next 50 years of Zulu history and would sow the seeds for the intervention of Great Britain into South African affairs. Before we sign off today, I'd like to tell you all about a new way to donate to our show. For those of you interested and able to, the Turning Tides podcast is now on Buy Me a Coffee. That's right, for as little as a dollar, you can help support the show. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the Turning Tides YouTube channel. We'll be premiering several short videos covering new and old topics soon. Thank you all again for listening, and have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.